Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. It's Christmas. It's our usual Christmas episode. Aaron, are you hiding in amongst all the presents?
I am. Well, no, I'm just hiding amongst the tree.
Right.
Yeah, but the presents are there. I'm just hiding in the tree. It's
fair
warm
enough.
Amongst the fairy lights.
Well, we've brought you in out of the cold, and hiding also over there in amongst the presents is my other half, Paris.
Sorry. Surprise!
And a ho 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 to you too.
Three Christmas cupboard dwellers.
Sorry,
indeed.
Just entered the podcast just quickly.
Are you going to keep that up for the entire episode? Are you going to pretend that you've got sort of Santa hanging around behind you?
That wasn't me.
Oh,
that was Santa.
Fair enough. I didn't.
He's going to be hanging around in the background, Gareth.
It sounds like a threat. Well, it's our usual Christmas selection box of festive species that we've got for you this year. And shall we launch into things or should we have another mince pie?
Do it.
Dash away.
Ah.
Oh, very good. On Gareth, on Paris, on Drew, wherever you are, and Jess. It's Christmas. Let's sound a little bit more excited. Let's do it.
Do it.
That was my Hans Gruber laugh.
On that subject, Die Hard is not a Christmas movie. Let's move on to the creature features.
Quick. Seconded.
It's the creature feature.
Let's ignore the fact that you just badmouthed one of the best Christmas Christmas films ever.
Die Hard is a cracking movie, but it's not a Christmas movie. That's like saying Iron Man 3 is a Christmas movie. It's not a Christmas movie. It just happens at Christmas.
No. It's traditional to watch Die Hard and then Muppet's Christmas Carol.
Then Home Alone and then The Snowman.
If it's just tradition, by the way, just because something's tradition doesn't make it right, but if you're going just by tradition, then Jason and the Argonauts, the old stop-motion Ray Harryhausen movie, is a Christmas movie. It's not. It's just on at Christmas.
We'll agree to disagree, and I'm just going to go and watch Die Hard after this. So, yeah. Shall we unwrap our very first present for this year, which, Aaron, you are unwrapping. What have you unwrapped?
Well, we obviously want to talk about the survivors of the extreme frozen realms near the northernmost lands, right? So I say, look no further than the Arctic fox. Living in the tundra habitats of northern Europe, northern Asia, and North America, the Arctic fox has a range distribution that is truly circumpolar. This includes Greenland, Iceland, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Murmansk, Oblast, Republic of Karelia, Russia, Alaska, Canada, and many of the islands that sit near these regions. This is an animal who certainly seems to be exceptionally well adapted for the cold tundras on a molecular scale. Every piece of its body plan puzzle is an integral part of its rejection of frosty defeat. With a small, rounded body, incredibly thick fur, and a fluffy tail, plus smaller ears compared to many of its fox king, the entire physical makeup of this species is aimed at insulation and minimizing heat loss. Very important around Christmas, of course. At roughly 46 to 68 centimeters in length, they aren't an apex predator, but they are an intelligent and well-equipped one. During the summer months, when the snow and ice recedes, exposing barren-looking grasslands with little cover, these guys are observed to be brownish-gray, darker, duller colors, perfect for hiding in the dirt and rocky outcrops there. They'll take on any small prey item, including rodents, hares, fish, birds, and eggs, but lemmings are their preferred and most common prey item. They're also great scavengers of the leftovers from kills made by wolves and bears. They may even eat the poo of these larger carnivores to extract any nutrients that may have got lost in their digestion process. And true to canine form, the Arctic fox is not above a little foraging, and it will often be observed eating berries and even seaweed. And speaking of things found by the sea, a defenseless seal pup in an ice den is a fantastic feast for these hunters. So they really do make the most of their habitat and the most of the resources around them. As winter tightens its grip, however, as it is here this time of year, the Arctic fox takes on its winter pelage, an impenetrably thick, multi-layered white coat that gives the best insulation of any mammal, and also allows the fox to near vanish in its snowy environment that it haunts. The fur even extends over the pads of the feet, a characteristic unique to Arctic foxes, providing both the essential heat insulation and the ability to silence their footsteps. It is during these winter months that the Arctic fox really demonstrates how special of an animal it is. In periods of such prey scarcity, starvation and freezing to death are real threats. But the Arctic fox has genes to control the rate at which fatty acids and glucose metabolize, even affecting insulin signaling. They are able to utilize metabolic depression, where the basal metabolic rate is slowed to minimize energy requirements, and conserve their body's fat reserves. It's a really incredible evolutionary answer to survival out there. They can also selectively widen and narrow the blood vessels in their feet to control heat loss through the pads, which, despite being furred, are still obviously in contact somewhat with the ground. And these adaptations, obviously, they prevent heat loss and reserve energy, are particularly important because there are times of the year when the difference between the body temperature of the Arctic fox and the atmospheric temperature around them is 90 plus degrees. That is a huge difference.
I'm assuming 90 degrees Celsius, not Fahrenheit.
90 degrees Celsius, yeah. The difference between their internal body temperature and the temperature outside. Their noses, it is amazing, isn't it? Incredible. To be able to survive in that and have all these genetic and physiological interior adaptations for it. Their noses, as I say, own an impressive sense of smell, able to smell carcasses up to 25 miles away. They may also use this to track down polar bears and exploit their kills. And they certainly use it to track down prey. Those seal pups I mentioned earlier can be detected 1.5 meters beneath the ice. But more importantly, that nose can detect lemmings under 77 centimeters of snow. And once that nose gets the fox in the ballpark, it's up to the ears to refine the exact location. Now, these ears are amazing. Whilst not quite as powerful as other canids, they do boast a functional range of about 125 hertz to 16 hertz, with a sensitivity of up to 60 decibels, which means the Arctic foxes can hear the lemmings burrowing beneath them under the snow and pinpoint their exact location. Now, once it is in a positive lock on its prey, it leaps straight up almost a meter vertically in the air before diving nose first into the snow and breaching through into the burrow, hopefully catching the lemon and the lemon, very different. and again, it's
lost lemon.
Yeah, very lost lemon, a very cold lemon, or a very acidic lemon. Either way, very enjoyable snack. Speaking of lemmings and not lemons, they don't just affect their hunting and dietary habits. In fact, the reproductive cycle of the Arctic fox is strongly linked to the lemming population density at the time. And this is cyclical and can change every 3 to 5 years, impacting the litter sizes of foxes through time. A total of 25 pups may be born to a vixen during times of plenty. And this is, incidentally, the largest litter size of all carnivores, though litters usually number much less. Whilst periodical scarcity will often result in zero births. And this is mainly a problem for the inland foxes. The coastal or blue morph enjoys year-round consistency in prey abundance and annually births 5 pups as a result. The breeding season for Arctic foxes begins in April and lasts through May. Now, leading up to this spring period, the foxes turn their attention to locating and preparing the den. Gestation lasts just over 50 days, and the pups are fully weaned by 9 weeks of life. Interestingly, the coastal morph displays more complex social structures, including pack lifestyle and polygamy, and this phenomena is often linked to higher predator population densities, red fox population density, and the need to better protect pup survival rates. The inland populations tend to be primarily monogamous. But how safe are the pups? What future lies in store for them? Well, currently, the IUCN Red List classifies them as of least concern, but this only really considers their global, or rather their Northern Hemisphere situation as a whole. A closer look tells us a different story, one of a species certainly endangered in some of its locales. The animal has cyclical breeding success for the most part, entirely hinging upon the success and abundance of lemmings and voles. And each time these prey species experience a population crash, the fox population follows suit, and they are very slow to recover. Hence why human persecution is such a huge problem, as numbers don't bounce back once protection is implemented. Also, much like the plight of the snow leopard that we spoke about a week ago, the Arctic fox is another species whose life relies greatly on the preservation of a habitat quickly diminishing in its coverage. Climate change and the warming phenomena that comes with it is not only shrinking the expanses of sea ice that these foxes use to migrate over. And by the way, I didn't cover that for this creature feature because there's far much to talk about with Arctic foxes, but look up the migration routes and habits of Arctic foxes. They are huge. But yeah, it doesn't just affect the sea ice that these guys transit over. It's also keeping that sea ice away for longer periods, meaning that it less and less of the year is given over to being able to allow these populations to move and genetic diversity to expand. Now, whilst the Arctic fox does spend part of its year on thawed out lands, the extended period of warmth and abundance is attracting a member of the family who is not so friendly and not so welcome in these parts. There's always that family rogue. Every family has one. The old-minded racist, or the family alcoholic, or the super aggressive third cousin. And for Arctic foxes, well, it's the latter. Whilst we will sit here and sing the praises of red foxes in the UK and how they're and how the merciless slaughter of them is beyond comprehension, they do pose a major threat when they cross into Arctic foxes' tundra environment. The red coat
Aaron, can I just point out, both of us are aware of this particular plight.
Indeed.
Purely from, and you may be aware of it as well, I don't know whether you've seen it or not, from the very, very excellent documentary series, The Octonauts. So there's an episode where one of the characters who's an Arctic fox has a bunch of red foxes turning up in his den.
Oh no.
Kicking him out, basically.
Yeah.
So
that's
yeah.
a very
I tell you what, Octonauts, hands down, is one of the best sort of shows for kids to learn about, you know, where the oceans and different species and that.
Yep.
I'll have to get my daughter watching that.
It's really good. I'd highly recommend it to anyone.
I think she has watched one or two, but yeah. So as I said, the red coat is better suited to camouflage in an increasingly snowless habitat, and reds will kill Arctic pups on sight. They'll even kill the adults if they catch them. And to make matters worse, the near eradication of grey wolves by humans. See, I thought I'd be able to work that in somewhere in this episode. One last time before the end of 2023. Because we've wiped out the grey fox across much of its territory in the Northern Hemisphere, it's left the red fox population largely uncontrolled in these areas, essentially opening the door for these red foxes to enter the tundra. So, very sad. And also, from what I could tell, there isn't actually a lot going on for Arctic foxes in terms of conservation. I mean, there are bits and pieces, and some of it is down to local communities just literally leaving meat out for the Arctic foxes. Aww. But there's not much else really that I could find or that I could talk about in a kind of shorter, compressed down version of a creature feature. But that's
I'd like
it.
To, That's really cool, literally, because of where they live. I'd like to add that's one of the first experiences of working with a fox I ever had was working with Arctic foxes. One of them was blue morph, and one of them was the proper white colored morph. He was a very, very old fox. He was blind. He had almost none of his teeth left. And he'd used to come and sit on you when you went in there. So you'd end up with this little fox just curling up on you. But they're lovely little foxes. Absolutely lovely.
I am really quite taken with the fox family. Very, very cool animals. Yes. That don't get enough credit and get far too much hate.
Definitely, yeah. They're really cunning little... Well, I mean, yeah, everyone goes with the cunning aspect, but they are. They're really intelligent. They're really good at doing what they do best, which is finding food in all sorts of different situations.
And a big shout out to those who leave meat out in the Arctic Circle. You're really brave. I mean, we leave food out here for things like hedgehogs and foxes in the UK, but we don't have any megafauna like a polar bear who might come along and eat it instead. So yeah, shout out to you guys. Thank you for doing that and being nice and brave.
It's a polar bear in the garden again. So shall we move on from Arctic foxes and unwrap our second present, which I believe, Faris, you have prepared for us. So what have we got?
My chosen festive focus is the marvellously majestic mistletoe. Now, the mistletoe we all in the UK likely know is the species with the white berries, Viscum album. There are over 1,500 species which are included in with the mistletoe family, but this is the only species native to the UK, as well as most of Central and Northern Europe, and was also introduced to Northern Carolina in 1900. In Old English, it was called mistletan, the word mistle meaning poo, and the word tan meaning twig or stick, literally translating as poo stick.
Does that mean if you're going to the toilet from now on, you can say, I'm going to drop a missile?
I guess so.
And why Aaron isn't laughing horrendously at the moment is because he had a drink in his mouth.
I was controlling myself because it wouldn't be the first time on this podcast where I've spat water.
I was
going to
say, that's your level of humour right there. Yeah.
So, yes, ladies, gentlemen, and non-binary listeners, all species of mistletoe are also toxic. The leaves, the stem, the berry, and even the root are all filled with tasty toxins. Some tasty side effects include hallucinations, high blood pressure, liver damage, hemorrhaging, diarrhea, vomiting, seizures, and even death. Festive fun all around there.
If symptoms persist, please see your doctor.
Absolutely. Don't eat it to begin with. being parasitic plants, they can photosynthesize for part or even all of their life cycles, species dependent. European mistletoe is able to do it all year round, but if you see a particularly yellow one, it's turned off its photosynthesizing and has become fully parasitic. They can switch back and forth as needed whenever they need nutrients. The seed has an extra sticky glue-like layer around it, usually sticks to a bird's beak when the berry is being eaten, which it will then wipe off on another plant at a later time. The sticky glue, I think it was called viscin?
Yeah, sounds about right.
Then hardens, permanently adhering it to the host tree or shrub, and for the first year or so, they just simply grow. Over time, they attach more permanently through a structure called a haustorium, which penetrates through the bark to both anchor the mistletoe and absorb water and nutrients from the host. They also leave their stomata open overnight to create a passive water gradient. The European mistletoe has smooth-edged, oval, evergreen leaves borne in pairs along the woody stem and waxy white berries that it bears in clusters of 2 to 6 from October through to May. This provides a food source for birds and squirrels during the harsher months of the year, and if an area is cleared of mistletoe, it's been found to decrease biodiversity across the board, including fox and badger numbers, not just bird populations.
How are they even getting to it?
Well, some birds drop them on the floor, and other animals eat them. The toxicity level to hedgehogs, foxes, and badgers is unknown, but obviously it does something, because it affects everybody. I also wanted to add in a little bit of background into the traditions of mistletoe. How and why we kiss under the mistletoe at Christmas, or to use it in our decorations, is one of those widely debated stories. Here's a few that I've found. One Norse story describes how the goddess Frigg cast a magic spell to ensure no plant grown from the earth could kill her son, Balder the Beautiful. However, mistletoe doesn't grow out of the earth, so it wasn't included. Unfortunately, a spear made of mistletoe killed Frigg's son Balder at what is our now Christmas time. So we've kind of absorbed that story into our own. And Frigg said she would kiss anyone who crossed under the mistletoe in memory of him. That's a sweet way of doing it.
Aaron, does that make him basically the Norse version of Jesus or something? Or that'd be Easter, wouldn't it? That's a stupid question.
Yeah. Also, to be fair, the resurrection and all that is, it all stems from, and Easter, it all stems from fertility stories of older religions.
And the other bit on Balder, which I just completely remembered, in Ragnarok, isn't he supposed to die from being crushed by a giant shoe? I'm sure there's something to do with a giant shoe killing Balder.
I can't remember. Balder is one of the ones whose fate I can't remember.
His fate is... His fate is unknown to me.
I should double check that.
You double check that in a minute. Yeah.
So another one I found interesting was that across the 17th and 18th century, farmers and servants were recorded to hang it up as to symbolise that life is not truly being gone through winter, and that kisses would be stolen and a berry plucked every kiss that was taken. Until all the berries were gone, and then no further kisses were permitted. It was possibly a way of giving men and women a way to express affection in times where women would have been forced into marriage for less.
I've got all the berries.
One kiss, one berry, guys. And then the last one I found had to do with druids around the first century AD. They revered mistletoe as a symbol of fertility as it blooms all year round. They used it in rituals, the oak and mistletoe ritual. I'll let you search that yourselves. It was a reason the Romans decided part of why the druids were so barbaric, just to give you a bit of a cautionary tale on that one.
Well, I mean, Romans, what have they ever done for us?
So the druids used it as a sort of medicine as well to treat fertility issues in both humans and animals alike, which, taking into account, it's toxic. Not sure how much it did, but nowadays we found it is also used to reduce chemotherapy side effects, helps treat cancer, HIV, arthritis, high blood pressure, and a wide other range of health concerns.
Druids knew what they were doing.
Absolutely. All that being said, mistletoe is covered by the same protection as all other wild plants in the UK through the Wildlife and Countryside Act. So you can harvest wild mistletoe, but not uproot the entire plant. So have yourselves a Merry Christmas with some mistletoe.
Okay. Oh. Random one. Your parents, didn't they? They tried to graft some mistletoe onto one of their trees, I'm fairly certain.
I believe they did, the oak tree, yeah.
Yeah, because it's one of the plants it parasitizes.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. It's the one that the druids would have preferred it grows from.
Oh, so next time we go around there, we're going to get all druidic.
You'll need a white cape, a golden scythe, and two bulls.
I'm on it.
just to clarify on the Balder note as well, I was a bit confused because I was under the impression he died way before Ragnarok, and it's his death that is actually what brings on Ragnarok. That's one of the factors that go into Ragnarok happening.
Because isn't it Loki that stabs him with the spear?
No, because Loki is often he's very much in the Marvel comics. He's very much a villain, whereas in Marvel films, he's kind of hero. Sorry, he's kind of a misunderstood character anti-hero. He swings between villain and anti-hero, but in the end, spoilers, almost every version of Loki in the multiverse ends up a hero in the end. But
in Norse mythology, in the Norse was that he was a bit of a twat and just stabbed Balder with his spear.
Yeah, he was often the one that caused the problems, but then the one that fixed it. He's basically a bit of a wind-up merchant, but it's his children that are kind of bring about Ragnarok. And I think it was Loki that stuck him with the spear, unless it was accident.
Is there
no,
a giant?
I know. I think Balder was killed by accident. I seem to remember Balder is killed by accident.
Yeah, there was no, I didn't go fully into it. It was just there was a lot of mention of Loki in the spear, and it was like he either did it or was involved with it. But I mean, the guy was called Balder the Beautiful, so I'm not sure if he was a necessarily nice person anyway.
Is there a giant?
Yeah,
suit?
Balder's supposed to be one of the best of them, like just nice, nice
just
and
a nice guy,
and,
really,
and handsome. Yeah, I believe
a really nice guy to hang out with, you know. But is there a big shoe? I'm determined there's a big shoe in here somewhere.
Yeah, so it's not Loki that kills him, although it is kind of indirectly. Basically, they're throwing things at Balder. So they're celebrating his immortality by throwing things at him as, you know, they all get drunk and they start throwing things. And there's a god who's blind called Hod. And Loki passes him a spear made of mistletoe. And tells him to throw at this, and that if he throws Balder at this, he'll be one of the lads.
This does sound very sort of
lads.
Hold my beer,
and it kills Balder, obviously, and then Loki ends up. That's the crime, the sin that finally, after like you know after millennia of him. Being a little shit stirrer, they finally have had enough of him, and the Aesir take him, and they bind him inside a cave with a snake bound above him, with its fangs milking the venom onto him, and it's burning him. And it's when he's released out of pity, I believe. I'm forgetting
that's
this,
what brings around Ragnarok.
Yeah, he goes and starts Ragnarok. We've gone on a hell of a tangent because of the
you know,
I said so there.
But you've still not answered my question. Where's the big shoe?
I don't know. The big shoe is confusing. I'm trying to think.
I'm going
to
look up the big
Thor
shoe in a minute.
Dresses or, but that's
something
another
about
funny
some
story.
Goats.
We'll be at masquerades this Friday.
Goats.
Anyway, shall we move on? And
I think we should, because we'll spend the whole podcast talking Norse mythology instead
and giant
of
shoes
instead of species and a festive species, which is what everybody's here for.
That and the giant shoes. this is the hill I'm dying on. Right. Well, before we just go on to my Christmas thing, just in the brief break that we took in between recording these two bits, I went and proved myself right. This is back on the Norse mythology thing. There is a giant shoe. There is a magic shoe. It is Vidar, who is the one of the participants of Ragnarok. It's his magic shoe that is made up from all of the other scraps and offcuts of every other shoe in the world. He uses that shoe, which is impenetrable to anything, to stand on the bottom jaw of the giant wolf Fenrir, whilst he then rips the head off after it just swallowed Odin. So, Merry Christmas! Nothing like a bit of gratuitous violence. I don't know. I think one day we should do like a mythology thing. I don't know. I think we'd get very stuck into that. But anyway, I digress massively. We're thinking about Christmassy things. It being the Christmas special and all. And when we think of Christmassy places on Earth, what comes to mind, guys?
Finland.
Finland?
Yeah, snowy northern realms.
Yeah. Finland, Greenland, Lapland, even Antarctica. These are the sort of places that we tend to think of when we think of Christmas. We think snow, we think ice, we think cold, pine trees, all those sort of things. Well, we are heading to a place where it is literally Christmas all year round. Now, to some people, that might be heaven, that might be hell to others. I'm sort of on the fence. As long as they're not playing Mariah Carey 24/7, I wouldn't be, you know, too upset. But we are heading to Christmas Island, a small island located in the Indian Ocean, about 350 kilometers 190 nautical miles, not naughty miles, south of Java and Sumatra, and around 1,550 kilometers away from the northwest of Australia. It's actually an Australian territory as well, Christmas Island, so it's sort of governed over autonomously, but it is dealt with by Australia in a lot of ways.
Barbecues and beers for Christmas instead of
skis. Yeah, what I would prefer for Christmas. Yeah, a nice tropical island for Christmas. So you might be wondering, why on earth does it get the name Christmas Island? Do either of you know? That's not because you just saw my screen at the same time, is it? Go on.
I think it's to do with a person instead of actual Christmas Day, but that's about as far as I'm willing to go on that.
It's to do with the day it was found by, well, I say found, discovered by Europeans. Captain Cook discovered it on Christmas Day. So they called it Christmas Island. I mean, you know, not a bad way to go about it. It could have been Halloween Island if they'd have been there a couple of months earlier. Or all sorts of different things.
For 4th of July.
I bet you there is an Independence Island. There is, isn't there? I've heard of it. I'm sure there's an Independence Island.
So yeah, Captain Cook gave it that name because he found it on Christmas Day. Now you might wonder at this point, where on earth is the creature that we're supposed to be featuring? I'm not just featuring an island instead of a creature. Well, this island is home to many different species, which obviously share the name Christmas Island. In fact, every second or third species seems to have the name Christmas Island, such and such. So I picked one that I think is probably one of the most synonymous with that place and also most iconic little creatures that you will find there. Yeah, the Christmas Island red crab. It's fascinated me for years after seeing documentaries of these crabs crossing the island in a migration that encompasses almost the entirety of the island in a swarm that some people would, well, think is heaven in my mind or hell to others, but certainly absolutely fascinating. This is a small little crustacean that has a lot going for it, I would say. So let's find out about this very Christmassy of crabs, shall we? So the Christmas Island crab, Geocarcoidea natalis. Firstly, this is a land crab. Now, to most people, the idea of a land crab seems very, very odd. Certainly to us in the Northern Hemisphere. When we think of crabs, we tend to think of them in the ocean. We don't tend to think of them living on land. But land crabs are quite a large group of crabs that basically only live on land. And in fact, this species lives its entirety of its adult life on land and would drown if they went into the ocean as adults. So, the idea of these guys being crabs like we tend to think of, very, very different.
They're covered in tinsel as well.
No, they're not covered in tinsel, although they are, as I'll tell you about in a second, a very Christmassy colour. So they also share this tropical paradise with another species of crustacean. In fact, one that we've looked at in a previous creature feature, and that's the coconut crab. Both of these species make an utterly fascinating island even more fascinating because there are multitudes of different species of crab that live on Christmas Island. And in fact, it's a place I've always wanted to go to. If we ever get a chance, we're on our way to Christmas Island.
Play the lottery.
Well, I wouldn't mind doing it for Christmas Day. I know that seems really cliche, and there's probably a lot of people who do exactly that, but would be interesting. And in fact, Christmas Island is renowned for these two species living, in people's gardens, turning up in all sorts of different places, and even occasionally in people's houses as well. So they're very well known amongst the people who live on Christmas Island. And in fact, the stamps and various different tourist stuff features this species, as well as the coconut crab as well. So the awareness around them is certainly there. And in fact, the plight of the Christmas Island crab has grown over the years, and people are more and more aware of them. And thankfully, I'd say that their popularity has also increased. And because of that, people are far more publicly minded to protect them. So what do these crabs look like? Well, they're red, like a really nice scarlet red color. So very Christmassy. In fact, if we had a bunch of them and stuck them on the Christmas tree over there, they'd make really nice sort of moving Christmas ornaments, I think.
Yeah, you know, you said about the whole heaven and hell thing. A I think that would go from heaven to hell in about 3 seconds.
Oh, no. Little crabs moving around the place.
Fine until they start getting into your bed with you.
Still not overly upset by that.
I'll pinch you later.
So they are relatively large compared to a lot of crabs. They have a carapace measuring up to 116 millimeters. That's 4.6 inches wide for anyone using Imperial. Their claws are usually of equal size, which a lot of crabs tend to have one larger than the other, but these guys just have them the same size. However, you can tell if an animal has been injured and lost a claw at some point and regrown one, as one will generally be larger if it's being regrown. And that does happen. The male crabs are generally larger than the females, whilst adult females have a much broader abdomen, which only becomes apparent about the age of 3 years when they start to become sexually mature. And that's for the obvious reason of them being able to hold eggs up against their body.
I know how they feel.
The females also usually have smaller claws. The bright red of their skin, or their carapace, sorry, is their most common color, but they have been noted to turn up in orange and even rarer, purple. Almost, for those Pokemon fans out there, it's the shiny form of this one. So they can live up to 12 years, making the following migration that they undertake even more amazing. So these are very long-lived invertebrates, and I think a lot of people underestimate just how long invertebrates can live, some of them, and don't tend to think of them in terms of long lifespans. So for most of the year, these crabs can be found within the interior of Christmas Island, in the forests, and they almost never leave the forest. It's humid. They've got their burrows underground where they can stay nice and safe from, well, anything that might be coming past. And they still need to be moist. They still need to keep their body moist to an extent, a bit like amphibians. Aaron's laughing at the word moist.
Just to be clear, I'm not laughing at the word. I'm laughing at, like, how I'm imagining the way people are reacting to hearing that word. And there's going to be at least some people hearing that word and, you know,
and squirming
or having their eyes twitch. And that's what makes me laugh. The effect a word has on people.
So at the start of the wet season, the crabs will start to carry out their migration. This is also partly to do with phases of the moon as well. So they're very, very well timed as to when they start to make this migration, to just make sure that every condition is right for the crabs. So it's usually between October and November, so should have finished by this point, and allows the crabs to basically increase their activity, the amount of rain and the humidity in the air, and stimulates their annual migration. So during this migration, these crabs abandon their burrows and they travel to the coast to mate and spawn. Now, this normally requires at least a week for them to make it from the interior to the coast. So that's quite a decent amount of time for, if you imagine, millions of crabs coming out of the forest and crossing roads, going through people's gardens, even going through people's houses, going down to the beach, an entire migration of these animals moving at once, this massive red crustacean carpet.
Sounds like a beach in Western, to be honest.
Fair enough. So it, like I say, it normally requires about a week for the male crabs, usually arriving before the females. And they do this so that once they get to the shore, the males can start to excavate a burrow, which they'll defend from other males. They're basically setting up their storefront to impress the girls and create a little temporary bachelor pad for them. So they'll then defend this from any other males in and around the area. Mating will occur in or near this burrow. And soon after mating, the males will basically, well, they'll disappear back into the forest. They'll head back home. Their job is done. They don't need to be doing anything else. So they'll start heading back towards the trees. So after this, the females stay in the burrow and they do this for about another 2 weeks. This period is where they start to lay their eggs and incubate them on their abdomen. If you've ever seen a crab with eggs, it's what is effectively their tail holding their eggs up against their body. It kind of looks like, I don't know, a little pouch almost, with lots of little black eggs up against their body, which they'll keep there until they get ready to basically release them.
They do the little dance.
This is what they do. So the females will then trot down to the beach in what can be the most dangerous part of the whole process for them. They will go to a rocky part of a beach, hang on as best as they can, wait for the waves to crash in, and then do a little dance. They basically stand there with their claws up in the air and shake their body to get rid of all of their eggs as much as they can as the waves come in. And hopefully the crab stays there on the land and the eggs get washed out to sea. And then the female will start to return back to the forest. Unfortunately, some of them will get knocked off the rocks. And if they don't get back to land, they will drown. So it's a very perilous little trip that these guys have to undertake. So the females then return to the forest while the crab larvae spend another 3 to 4 weeks at sea before returning to land as tiny, tiny little juvenile crabs. So you get this same migration happening in sort of three phases, I suppose. So the people of Christmas Island will witness these animals on the move at least three times. The first time is obviously when they come down from the forests. The second is when they start to return to the forest. And the third is obviously when these juvenile crabs start returning to land and covering the place in this really almost fine red carpet of lots of tiny little crabs moving off into the woods to start their journey and become a nice big Christmas Island crab. Now, along this way, this can lead to the crabs encountering anything and everything in people's homes, gardens, and unfortunately, where they also tend to come into conflict with humans. Now, in the past, a lot of them were killed by people not liking them or not wanting them. Nowadays, opinions and attitudes towards these crabs have changed massively. The people of Christmas Island will actively move the animals out of the road. There are signs to make sure that people are aware that the crabs are in the area. Although, to be honest, if you're driving down a road, you're gonna see these crabs. They're everywhere. And the unfortunate ones that don't make it across the roads, if someone manages to drive over them, become food for other crabs at the side of the road. They've also been said to actually puncture the tires of passing vehicles if you try and drive over them. So they're sharp enough that you wouldn't want to do it. So there's definitely incentive not to bother driving over them because you want to protect the crabs. And two, you don't want to ruin your tires. I know I wouldn't. Absolutely. I think I would just go, right, I'm not driving this week. I don't need to go anywhere.
I said walk, but if you fall over, are they going to eat you?
You'd have to lie there for a while, I think. They're not like sort of
zombie crabs.
Some sort of piranha, like, you know, drop to the ground, rip you to pieces sort of thing. No, they're quite pleasant little creatures. So to combat this, like I say, there've been signs put up to make sure that people don't drive over them for good reasons, but they've also introduced what are called crab bridges, which are exactly what it sounds like. They are bridges of with like a, almost like a jungle gym style thing with netting that goes up and over the roads and allows the crabs to basically just climb up and go over. And yeah, they work quite well. So it's a sign that, you know, people can live with this absolutely bizarre once a year situation for just a week. I mean, you know, or 2-3 weeks. It's not exactly forever. So let's talk about the animal's predators for a second, because, well, other than when they're at the larval stage in the sea and filter feeders like whale sharks are considered probably the most prominent predator for these little crabs, they actually have no natural predators on land. There's nothing there that really poses them a threat, apart from humans. Obviously, humans, you know, pose a threat to literally everything on the planet in one shape or another. But you don't have to worry about people eating them because apparently they don't taste very nice either. So evidently at some point someone tried to eat them. I mean, crabs are kind of tasty. So I could understand why someone would give it a go. But apparently they don't taste very nice. But unfortunately, there are some animals that do seem to like the taste of these crabs. And unfortunately, this is now their biggest predator. It's an animal that they've not evolved to deal with either. And in fact, is a really horrible way for these animals to die. And that's the pincers and the stinger of the yellow crazy ant.
Oh.
And just as the name sounds, they are yellow and they are, well, they're definitely ants and they are crazy as well. So they were introduced to the island like many other places around the world. In fact, they've actually been found here in the UK as well, in lots of different places. They were introduced from Africa and they've caused absolute chaos. It's believed that they've killed 10 to 15 million crabs. That's one quarter to one third of the total population. So in recent years, the ants themselves have basically decimated crab numbers on this island. And it's because they are so small, the crabs can't do anything. Basically, think of the crab as a giant sort of titan compared to these ants. The ants are so small that they basically can sting in between the armor plating that the crab has on all its soft points. And it becomes a death by a thousand paper cuts. Lots of tiny, tiny venomous stings between that armor. And the crabs themselves just become overwhelmed by the venom and unfortunately die a very horrible death. And then the ants will do what ants do best, which is pull them apart.
Just reuse, recycle, people.
Well, and even some of the true giants of the crab world, the giant coconut crabs, have even been taken down by these ants as well. Yeah, they're a real risk from the ants themselves. But there are ongoing plans to trap and kill as many of these ants as possible. There is ongoing plans to basically trap and kill as many of these ants as possible. Unfortunately, though, this will have to be an ongoing fight. And thankfully, the people of Christmas Island seem to love their crabs and want to do as much as they possibly can to help them and survive into the future and wipe out the yellow crazy ant from their islands, because it's, well, it's doing no good whatsoever. So then we have the Christmas Island red crab, crab species number two for me.
Oh, yeah, of course. Especially, it is, yeah.
Well, actually, it's technically crab species number one, because if you remember, the Christmas Island crab.
Coconut
crab is not actually a crab.
It is not.
The second species from the same island. I seem to get stuck on islands with species. It seems to be the way of me doing things. I'm stuck on the islands.
Stuck on the island with crabs.
Yeah. And like I say, one day I will make it there and I'll lie down and let the crabs crawl all over me or something. Like some sort of weirdo.
That would be weird.
Yeah, but it would be interesting. Make one hell of a postcard. Why'd you end up in hospital? Well, the crabs started to eat me.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So there we have it. Let's we've unwrapped all three of our Christmas creature features for this year. And we have just enough time to delve into the selection box that is our emails for this week and wrap things up, I guess.
Bing! You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email.
Right, well, the mince pies are almost finished. The chocolates are sort of halfway through. The wine's open. Oh, dear. Aaron, another bit of turkey or... Yorkshire pudding or something like that?
I'll definitely go for another Yorkshire pudding.
I think it's impossible not to. But before we get into that, we've got this week's question, which was, what animal or plant do you best feel symbolically covers this time of year? So it was not specific to Christmas. It could be this time of year anywhere in the world. Obviously, it definitely has more of a... winter solstice feel to northern hemispheric countries as opposed to southern hemisphere where it's usually a lot warmer. But we'll start these off. We've got a few different ones that have come in from Lindsay Kinsella. Tricky, I can't think of any animal that eats its own body weight in cheese. Aaron, you tried to eat your own body weight in cheese?
I mean, I have done. My friends will tell
that's
you
impressive.
Of this masterpiece cheese on toast that I made once for them called the Grizzly. And the Grizzly was, you know, like your standard, if you imagine a standard piece of toast, you toast it just a little bit. Here's a recipe, natural history cupboard recipe for you all that will both make you incredibly unhealthy.
Will come out soon.
Probably burn your Christmas money away. And it's probably not the best thing to make anyway. But yeah, just lightly toast the slice of bread and then spread on some Philadelphia cream cheese, put down some thin slices of cheddar, then some red Leicester, then grate on it what cheese is it? Edam? Yes, Edam. And then put some brie on top. And then you put some Liam Perrins on that, shove that underneath the grill in your oven. And when
all
it's
the doctors just to let them know you'll be coming in for a heart attack later.
Or when it's almost done, you bring it out and you put some Parmesan cheese on top.
Oh my God.
And then you put it back under the grill to finish it off. That was the Grizzly. And it looked like it was my weight in cheese. certainly felt like it after I'd eaten it.
I was going to say, yeah, that I don't think you'd have been moving very fast afterwards. So moving on from the cheese there. Jen Babs has put, I like the symbolism that is associated with the solstice. So for me, it's the moon gazing hare picture attached from the internet. And it's a picture of a hare sort of jumping over what looks like the moon or the sun rising up. Aaron Escher Brenner Cocker has put caribou for animal. Christopher Benjamin Kent, Homo sapiens during the Black Friday migrations, which is a very, very dangerous species to be around at that point. Amy Elizabeth Tucson has put poinsettia, that plant that everyone rushes out to buy and then is usually dead by mid-January. Jeff Johnson has put New Zealand's bird of the century, the putekiteki. I think it had to find its way in there somewhere. Aaron Escherbrenner Cocker has also put aspen trees as well, which they're quite a nice species of tree, an aspen. And Scott James Puddingham has put long-eared owls coming in for their migration. So a long list of species there that really sum up this time of year. I think there's some good ones there. And not one person put reindeer, which is good.
Yeah, I thought someone put caribou, didn't they?
Yeah, all right, but that's the non-domestic version.
Yeah,
isn't it?
But it's still good enough. I agree with Erin there. Reindeer.
I mean,
is
I
the
like them.
For me, caribou.
I know you like them quite a bit.
Mm.
So we're not going to pose you a question for the coming week because, well, we're going to be doing something special next week. We went for a bit of a ramble. We've actually recorded this ahead of time. And in fact, in the process, you managed to injure yourself along the way, didn't you?
Yes, I'm still recovering from it.
About two, three. It's an interesting ramble where we've decided to go out of the cupboard. It's weird, the outside world. We're not going to pose a question this week, but it is now the point in the show where the second to last time of the year, we get to sing the praises of our wonderful Patreons, which in the process of us doing what we did for the New Year's episode has been partly paid by their wonderful donations. So here to say a big thank you to our Patreons is Santa, I believe.
Yes, I'm not going to do it this week. I'm going to just budge over for Santa here.
No, come on, Santa. Yeah, there he is.
thank you very much, Gareth and Aaron and Paris and Drew and Jess back home. You've been very good this year. Wonderful artwork and wonderful posts on the Twitter there. I don't know how to work it anymore. That Elon Musk is sending up too many satellites trying to track me because of childhood trauma.
He's a naughty boy.
He is on my naughty list. Well, then let's find out who's on my nice list this year. Who will be getting some good presents? The podcasts have asked me to thank their Patreon supporters. And this festive season, I would like to be thanking Chelsea McKee, Honey P, Jen Greenhall, and Fogtober. You've been very, very good little podcast helpers. Thank you so much. The guys at the podcast, they thank you too. Now I'm going to go saddle up in the sleigh and go back on my wayward journey. Merry Christmas, one and all. On Dasher, on Dancer, on Prancer, on Vixen, go Comet, go Cupid, go Donner and Blitzen.
He's gone.
I mean, what you can't see there, folks, is he managed to fit an entire herd of reindeer into Aaron's house.
I was very happy to have them, Gareth. I will clean up after them. They weren't fed. But don't worry, anybody whose house is getting visited next after ours, don't panic. You won't have sick reindeer because I made sure to feed them moss and lichen, not carrots. And also any time that someone wants to bring reindeer in my house is going to be absolutely fine by me.
I'll hold you to that. I'm going to go and find some.
I would love reindeer.
So, well, as Santa just pointed out there, it was our wonderful Patreon listeners. Yes. So thank you very much to them. You guys help us out fantastically by, well, helping us out financially and allowing us to go out and do more and more bizarre things and hopefully not to try and injure my wife too much in the process. Yeah. Well, no skydiving next. Big thank you to you guys, but also a big thank you to anyone and everyone, because all your support helps out immensely, whether that's just listening to the show, also sharing any of our social media posts, interacting with us on social media as well, telling a friend, telling an enemy, telling anyone and everyone who you can. And now you can officially say that Santa listens to us as well. I mean, you know, what better endorsement can you get there? So the big thank you from myself and Aaron and Paris and everyone here at the podcast. And a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah. And that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's episode and our Christmas episode. So we'll be heading off now, I suppose, and go and delve into another box of chocolates or into some wine or some pigs in blankets or something like that. So big thank you, Aaron, for coming along. And Merry Christmas to yourself. Much.
Merry Christmas to you too.
Yep. Big thank you, Paris, for also coming along. Merry Christmas. That's okay. And Merry Christmas to you all at home. And we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Bye.